Hello and welcome to another episode of The Brave Front, the men's mental health podcast that aims to shatter the stigma by sharing inspiring stories and talking to inspiring people. My name's Tim Bainan, and if you're new to the show, please follow us on your usual podcast platform. And if you like what you hear, which I hope you do, leave us a review too, both of which help other people to find the show. And we want to hear from you too, so check out our episode questions and polls, send us a voice message, or get in touch to come onto the show yourself. All the links you need are in the show notes. Now though, it's on with the episode, and here's what's coming up in the next hour as we take a close look at professional sport and mental health.
The evidence that you look at, and this is, so the studies that have looked at it, over 50% of sports people will suffer from some form of mental health challenge within 2 years of retirement. The way it was described to me by a rugby player, said, like, how often in life do you lose your job, your hobby, and your friendship network all on the same day? In any high-performance sport environment, yes, there is always going to be a talent pathway that only a certain number of people, there are only a certain number of jobs there, but it doesn't mean that we have to have the collateral damage of people's well-being for those that don't quite manage to succeed in terms of fulfilling their ultimate ambitions. So if the system is telling you that you need to focus on your performance, and if you're not doing that, you're not prioritizing your sport, is it any wonder that you've got a lot of sports people that are head down focusing on their sport and not thinking about anything else?
That was Rob Young, MBE, Chief Executive of Switch to Play Foundation, the only UK charity that supports the well-being of professional sportsmen and women as they transition to life after sport. Having dedicated their lives to the sports they love, focusing on their goals from the youngest of ages and pursuing their dreams with a single-minded determination to succeed, it's no wonder the sportsmen and women struggle when their careers come to an end or are cut short. In 2019, Craig Fallon, Britain's 2005 judo world champion who competed at Athens 2004 and Beijing 2008, tragically died by suicide at the age of just 36 after suffering severe depression. And over recent years, many former professional athletes have bravely spoken of the psychological challenges they faced and are continuing to face after retiring. Track cyclist Callum Skinner, who won gold and silver at the Rio Olympics in 2016, is just one example. He has spoken openly about the depression he experienced after retiring, and now he campaigns to help other athletes going through the grief leaving their careers behind them. Rower and double Olympic medalist Alex Partridge, meanwhile, admitted to the wheels having come off his life after he retired following the 2012 Games. And there are countless other examples, many of whom have gone on to be supported by Switch to Play Foundation, a charity headed up by today's guest, Rob Young, after he and his colleagues recognised the need for an independent organisation to support all professional sportsmen and women in preparing for and transitioning into life after sport, in whatever form that may take. So I was delighted to have the opportunity to sit down with Rob and to chat about the mental health challenges facing those professional sportsmen and women who we watch, admire, and cheer on every day. They excel at the sports the rest of us only ever dabble in, achieving the things we can only ever dream of. But just like the rest of us, they're also facing their own mental health challenges. Rob, welcome. Thank you for joining us on The Brave Front. Really great to see you, and I'm really grateful for you taking your time, taking some time out of your busy day to join us. Tell me, where do we find you today? Where's home, and where are you talking to us from?
So I'm in Stockport, in Greater Manchester. So we're a remote based charity, Switch to Play Foundation. So our team's all over the country, but I have the joys of being up in the Northwest.
Good stuff. What does an average day for the CEO of Switch to Play have in store? What do you usually get up to?
I'm smiling because no 2 days are alike, and I know that people might just sort of say it sounds quite cliched, but genuinely, it is incredibly varied. Obviously, from the work that we do with athletes and setting up programs and supporting athletes in different ways that we do, through to the work that we need to do in terms of fundraising and as a charity, making sure that we're bringing in investment to make sure we can deliver the programs and support the athletes.
Excellent. As someone who works for charity, I fully get where you're coming from. There's always two sides to the work, isn't there? You know, you've got to spend as much time raising awareness and making sure people understand what you're doing. Then you also, you've got to make sure they spend the time bringing the money in to do the work that you need to do. So yeah, I totally get where you're coming from on that side. But listen, I'm fascinated to find out more about Switch to Play and the work that you do and the incredible difference you're making to professional sportsmen and women across the country. But before we delve into that, perhaps just give me a little bit of background about yourself and you know, where you've come from to get to this point. Are you do you live and breathe sport yourself?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's just, I always feel like it's the imposter syndrome when you're the founder and chief executive of a charity that supports elite sports people, because I never played at the top level myself, which is usually the first question I get. I've always been around sport. That was none of my paths. It's as simple as that. And if I wasn't going to be good enough to play at a top level, then having a career in it in some capacity was always the thing for me. I was very lucky that I was able to work on the 2012 Olympics and Paralympics for 6 years, which was an incredible experience. So a role around the legacy of the Games and how we ensured that it was a Games for the whole of the UK and that it did bring lasting sporting, social, economic benefits to the UK. That's probably a topic in its own right. But and then conversations with friends back in 2014, and when you're your own boss, I had my own consultancy company, and we started talking about the experiences that we were having with knowing friends or people that were struggling coming out of sport. And it was common themes that we were having about just the struggles that they were having, the lack of support that was there. And I guess the naive conversation that you have is, should we do something about it, be a bit more part of the solution? And really, that was the genesis of what Switch to Play was originally, as a social enterprise, and more latterly converted to charitable status in 2020.
Fantastic. And during that whole period, that whole time when you're sort of working in and around professional sport, were you aware at the time then that because I imagine in that those roles you had sort of looking after and build up to the Olympics and so on and so forth, were you aware, did you have much sort of day-to-day contact with sportsmen and women, and did that sort of educate you in terms of opening your eyes to some of the challenges they were facing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the genesis for me is my experiences at Loughborough Uni. So obviously it's a very sporting university that your peer group are people that are going to Commonwealth Games, Olympic Games, and my sport was football. And I remember, like, all your peers have been at a professional club at some point in their youth, but you're coming across people that, in this instance, they were landing in a great educational environment, getting the support and continuing their football aspirations alongside their education. But the experiences they were having around just like falling out of love with the game. And ultimately, we play sport. We do it because we love it. It's fun. And actually, like, sport shouldn't beat it out of us to the point that we never want to play football again, or we never want to do it again because the experience has been so negative. Now, in any high-performance sport environment, yes, there is always going to be a talent pathway that only a certain number of people, there are only a certain number of jobs there. But it doesn't mean that we have to have the collateral damage of people's well-being for those that don't quite manage to succeed in terms of fulfilling their ultimate ambitions.
Also, I mean, it's funny because I spent a part of my career working for Fulham Football Club. I used to look after the publications and some of the media for Fulham Football Club. So I saw sort of third hand there, and you know, a lot of the youth system and the young players that would go through the ranks, and I could see how driven they were, how passionate and determined they were to make it. But ultimately, the numbers that went through to the first team were tiny, and there were the numbers of kids who were let go or went off to other lower division clubs and so on and so forth far outweighed the number who actually made it through. So that must be hugely challenging for kids, especially at a young age.
Yeah, and like early specialization sports sports where there's obviously very, like, football, obviously given the level of investment around where the talent pathway, and people could argue whether it's a talent pathway, but where people are starting to bring people into a talent pathway, it's hard. Your kids, first and foremost, you know, we talk about the UN Convention around Rights of Children, like, and we look at what goes on in talent pathways. Well, hang on a second. First and foremost, you need to be able to be a kid. And like, you can have a fantastic experience with these environments, but it can also be, you know, really challenging. And if you think about the biggest factor when you look at the evidence that's been done on this and you speak to a sports person, the biggest trigger point around transitioning to life beyond sport is around identity. And if from 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, all you've been known as Tim the footballer, take the footballer bit away. You're not Tim the footballer. You're Tim who plays football. And those two statements are fundamentally different. But actually, so many sports people get intrinsically drawn in with their athletic identity. Well, they're far more than that. And when you take that away, and it could be injury or actually the end point of your career, that's a massive thing that people have to process, as well as all the other things that you need to be doing in terms of what next and some of the practical stuff about jobs and paying bills and all of those things.
It is interesting because I've spoken to many sports men and women over the course of my career, and quite often, especially those who are reflecting back on a career, on a successful career. We've had people on this show talk along these lines, and they say, you know, it was the only thing I ever wanted to do. It was all I wanted to do. I wasn't very good at school. Didn't really get on with school. This was all I wanted to do. It was my every waking hour. I did it all the time. Got great support from my parents and my family. I got great support from my coaches. I did all this and did all that. That's a huge amount of pressure on someone at a young age. And I can see how easy it is for them to be single-mindedly focused on what they're passionate about, but at the expense of everything else. So at the expense of school, perhaps, and at the expense of having a fallback, having something they could fall back on.
And our big thing is that we believe fundamentally better people make better athletes. So if we present the work that we do as Plan B, we're immediately placing a worth on it that says it's less than Plan A. And who in life puts as much effort into Plan A, into Plan B, as you would Plan A? So, like, unless we can see it as going, actually, do you know what? If I do these other things, they're going to help me be a better footballer, cricketer, runner, whatever. And so, you know, in some very, I'll give you a particular example. One of our founding trustees was Beth Tweddle, Olympic gymnast. And Beth always talks about in her career, the worst year of her career was when she had no outside interests, because she basically was eat, sleep, train, repeat. But the baggage of a training session would stay with her, because that's what, like, that was basically her life. And it was her coach who said, Beth, you need to do something else. So she went to university, became Beth the student. And it just got out of the bubble. And actually, for your own well-being, you need to get out of that performance bubble. And in doing so, you might be learning some stuff and developing different skills and things that you can bring back into the sporting context. But that identity, you can't live in that high-performance bubble 24/7, because it's intense and difficult naturally because of what the sporting journey you're trying to achieve. It's hard. So you need to have a release. So at that level, if nothing else, like the stuff that we talk about is really, really important.
Yeah. And have the studies shown and do you see in the course of your work that elite sportsmen and women are they wired differently to the rest of us, in the fact that you have to, you know, most of us play sport for the fun of it and can leave it alone and leave it behind us and so on. But you know, and most of us, when it comes to our work, even are the same. We can do our work, but then we can shut the door on it and get on with the rest of our life. But us, are people who are so driven and so focused, are they mentally wired differently to make sure that they get to that point? It must take something special to get people to that point that they need to get to.
It's a really great question. I think there are traits that you would see in sports people, and we talk about transferable skills a lot, but like there are traits that you see quite commonly exhibited really strongly in sports people that you might not necessarily see as strongly elsewhere. I'll give you an example of one that I personally was like, whoa, when I was, you know, the more I was working with sports people at first, like in those first experiences, and it was about feedback. So sports people, because they understand the value of feedback, so a coach or somebody like, you're giving me feedback because if I get that feedback, it's going to help me get better. So you see it as a self-improvement tool, where so often in life, someone giving you some feedback, and it might be constructive and not always positive in terms of what you might be done, but like we don't want it. We don't want to hear that stuff. We don't want to, well, actually sports people embrace it.
Okay.
They understand the value of it. So there are sort of traits like that that you see in sport that you go, actually, that's amazing. You can translate that into a different context. That's a superpower. So, like, there's absolutely things like that. I mean, we talk a lot about teamwork, and even in individual sports, you hear and see athletes talk about the team, because they might be in an individual sport, but there's a sports scientist, there's a coach, there's all the people around them that's helping them to perform at their peak on a given day. And they recognize it's not just them, ultimately gets them to the podium.
It is a strange one in terms of the fact that there are so many, you know, there is so much work that goes into getting you to a certain point. And as you say, it is interesting. I'm fascinated to hear your thoughts on those mental differences between the rest of us and elite sportsmen and women. And it's interesting that they're quite accepting potentially of criticism, of critique, of people telling them that's wrong. Do it, you know, you're doing it wrong. You should be doing it this way. But are they missing anything in terms of perhaps being able to assess in the long term? Do sportsmen and women think inevitably about just the next step? I've got to get better. I've got to improve. I've got to do this. Do they fall down when it comes to sort of more longer term thinking in terms of the fact that, you know, my career might only be 30 years. What am I going to do after that? Is there something that just means they're in the moment all the time and not perhaps thinking longer term?
It's a great question. I'm thinking of like different examples of people. I think there's a bit for me that's actually about the system. And this is a bigger thing than what Switch the Play Foundation, but it's absolutely something that we believe needs to happen. It's like, how do we change a sporting system that recognizes the value in developing yourself as a human being? Because there's a duty of care part, but it's also that bit actually is equal health performance. So if the system is telling you that you need to focus on your performance, and if you're not doing that, you're not prioritizing your sport, is it any wonder that you've got a lot of sports people that are head down focusing on their sport and not thinking about anything else? So sometimes that's about the product of the system, but you'll absolutely meet sports people that are forward thinking and things like that. And sometimes it's the environment they come from, because their parents have been very encouraging around those things. So I think that, like, these things are all contextual for me. So a strength in certain situations could be a weakness in others. So I'll give you an example of that. So I think you'll find a lot of sports people I've spoke to are very purpose-driven. So example a bit, like, we're in an Olympic Paralympic year. So you'll speak to a lot of sports people. They know the date of their event. They've known that for 3 years. That's that focal point. They know what the top of the mountain looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So in life, you take that. That's a skill, because then they can plan and they will be meticulous in what they need to do to get to the top of the mountain. Well, they need to find that purpose outside of sport. And if you can't find that, or you're struggling, that could be where there's a real challenge that people find. If they find it, and I guess that's some of the work that we do around helping them identify values and purpose, it's a superpower again. But actually, it's a real challenge for people that are very focused on a particular place, and actually trying to translate that into a different context, it can be a weakness or a challenge.
Yeah, I imagine there's challenges at every step of the way, though. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like. If imagine going into an Olympic year like this, and you've been preparing for it for the last 4 years, and you're on the you know, the verge of you know, getting somewhere, but then perhaps in, you know, an athletic meet, you know, a couple of months before, you pick up an injury that therefore could rule you out of the thing you've been working for 4 years. That's something that's probably unique to sport in that sense. The rest of us, you know, there are ways around, you know, we're still going to get on with our day-to-day jobs. I can't really think of other examples in life where you are so focused on something, but something else can happen that just throws it entirely off course. How on earth do you mentally build resilience in order to cope with something like that?
Yeah, and I guess it's a great question, because I think we look at sports people and see them as resilient individuals, because there's the famous quote by Michael Jordan, isn't it, that people talk about, like, how many shots he's missed in his career and how many games he's lost, and we look at him as being one of the greatest sports people of all time. Like, the reality is, in sport, even if you are elite, you are still going to suffer a lot.
You're going to lose setbacks at some point. Yeah.
how you come through that is obviously fundamentally part of it. That can be quite draining, though, when you think about like that focus. If you don't have release, you don't have perspective around this isn't everything. My value as a human being isn't judged on a performance in 6 months' time in Paris. It's far more than that. And having other things in your life actually are really important to that. Now, I had a conversation with a now retired Olympian who's been very successful and lucky to win multiple gold medals. And I was just asking him about his transition and his journey. And the thing that was fascinating listening to him, he talked about always having other interests. So dispelling the myths about you can't do anything else. But he talked about the fact he had his job lined up so that when he was on the start line in his last race, an Olympic final in Rio, he was both focused and relaxed. Never as focused on his performance because he didn't have in the back of his mind what happens next because he'd sorted that bit. And so again, yeah, it just shows the value of how these things interrelate that can actually support performance and support your mental well-being and not detract from it. And I think that's it. It's not like about it doesn't make it worse. It can be additive, not just a net neutral, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And I imagine that, I suppose, the things sportsmen and women learn along the way help them through life in general. So I've always been amazed when you look at elite sportsmen and women, you know, stepping into the ring or going onto centre court or about to kick off in a FA Cup final, whatever it is, or World Cup final, whatever. These huge events where the eyes of the world are on them. Not only is the pressure on, not only do they want to do well for themselves, but they've got the nation supporting them, or their fans, or their their family and loved ones there with them as well. Huge amount of pressure, but it doesn't show. They look calm, they look focused, and they talk about it when you talk to them about it, in terms of the fact that I tuned all that out and I was just able to focus. So that in itself is a mental strength, isn't it, in terms of having that ability to do that, and that must serve them well in life in general.
Yeah, we do. So some of the life skills sessions that we do with, say, young footballers, for example, we talk about transferable skills, and a lot of people talk about that. And actually, part of the job that we're trying to do is help people recognize how you can translate those skills, because sometimes you look at a job description, the thing they're asking for is the thing you've got, but they're asking for it in a different set of words, but it means the same thing you've been doing. And actually recognizing that's a translatable skill that has currency that employers are looking for is something like, A, that gives them confidence, but also helps them set them on a direction. So yeah, massively. Like, there are companies that we work with that inherently get that, and they go, we will recruit you because we recognize those soft skills, if you call, like, are the skills that have huge value in the workplace. We can train you the technical skills, but actually you will be a great employee because you have these things that you can bring to a workplace.
Right. So that's part and parcel of what you guys do then, is to help people to understand that. I'm trying to build a picture in my mind of that sort of mental landscape that elite sportsmen and women have. And it's interesting to hear you talk about those transferable skills and how they can serve them well in later life. And I imagine that is the challenge that you're facing is and the work that you do then essentially in Switch to Play is to, as you mentioned the word transition, is to help people to prepare for that transition, and when they get there to make a life after sport.
Yeah, and we don't it's not for us to define what that end point for somebody looks like, but like, and that could be so different, and it goes far beyond the job. Because when we think about it, and you think about like well-being, you think about it, there's an occupational bit, yes, there's a physical bit, there's a mental emotional piece, there's a purpose and values piece, and all of those things come together because that's us, who we are as people. So our model is very much around prevention. So all the evidence shows if you wait to the end of your sporting career, and for over 70% of sports people, it's not on your terms, injury, contract non-renew, deselection, that there's a big dip in the change curve. If you've seen the change curve, that the Kubler-Ross change curve, when they talk about managing change, there is that dip. And that's inevitably going to be there. It's a hard change to manage. So how can we work with people early and throughout their sporting journey to build skills, to build interests, to identify some of these things so that whenever the end point comes, and hopefully it's on your terms, and like we can't all end like Stuart Broad in the Ashes and winning a test. Still, when the end point comes, you're in a great place. And you've got a sense of direction and purpose and identity of you as a human being. So that all starts from younger athletes all the way through your sporting journey. The harder group to speak to are younger athletes and those in the peak of their career, because naturally sporting performance is foremost in their mind.
Yeah, and a bit of Peter Pan complex going on there in there in terms of the fact that I'm at the top of my game. You know, I don't need to worry about that yet. I'll park that till later. But What are the risks of not preparing? What if you didn't do what you've just talked about and you didn't spend the time preparing for what is going to come? What are the risks, or what's the worst case scenarios that people could be facing?
The evidence that you look at, and this is, so the studies that have looked at it, over 50% of sports people will suffer from some form of mental health challenge within 2 years of retirement. Like it, and that's self-reported. So like, imagine what the reality of that is. And I've spoken to people that have said, you know, even the people that you would think would be in the best possible place for their post-sporting, but like found it hard. It's hard. And it's hard because to dispel some myths, like most people who play sport at a high level do not make life-changing sums of money through playing sport. So they're not set for life financially. So you need to earn, you need to make decisions that get money in, pay bills, etc. And you don't end on your terms. So you'd like that point of dealer, and not everyone's going to necessarily have achieved what they want. So there's some baggage around that. So managing change, it is a really tough process. So the that manifests itself in mental health issues and financial challenges. What we're trying to do is prevent those things from happening, and to shallow that change curve and allow people to find a positive place in their future. Because the things that we talked about a short while ago about those transferable skills, there are people and organizations that hugely value that stuff. Mm-hmm. So like there's opportunity and there's stuff to be excited by. And most of your post-sporting career is likely to be longer than your sporting career. So there's an opportunity to embrace it and be excited by it. Yes, it's scary and unknown in some respects, but that, and then that mindset, I think, is really important to it. And yeah, helping people to make sure that they are, know that there's support there for them, that they can talk and share, because vulnerability is something that sports people don't often talk about. But yeah, ultimately what we're trying to do is prevent people from really struggling.
Sure. I make an assumption here as well, but I'm assuming that for most professional sports men and women, life, when they're playing or when they are in their sports, is driven by routine, in terms of the fact that they get up at a certain time, they go to training at a certain time, they play a game at a certain time, or their events are at a certain time. And they have those routines about around every aspect of their lives, when they train, when they eat, when they sleep, all that kind of stuff. So that must be hard to, when that comes to an end.
I'm smiling because there's a couple of bits. So like Leon Lloyd, who's an ex-Tigers England rugby player, who was one of our my predecessors, chief exec, he basically always talks about he knew what he had to wear, where he needed to be, and what he needed to eat 2 weeks on Thursday. And then all of a sudden, the guy, I've got to decide what I'm having for lunch today. I've got to decide what I'm wearing. And it, these things sound quite trivial in some respect, but it's just this bit about the routine that you're in, and actually some of the things that you may not have done yourself that you're now having to like process these, some of these things. The way it was described to me by a rugby player, said, like, how often in life do you lose your job, your hobby, and your friendship network all on the same day?
Yeah, God. Yeah.
That's
wow.
Like in team sport, like this, that's what it feels like when you retire from a team sport environment. And you think they'll miss you, and yes, at a personal level they will, but someone's wearing your shirt the next week because life goes on.
Yeah.
You're processing all of this stuff, and all of that stuff has been stripped away.
Yeah. Gosh, that's got to be, that's a, you know, what a quote that is. That's really powerful. Well, I can see exactly what that's like for a team sport, but imagine for individual sports as well. Imagine you look at swimmers who are used to, for since they were children, getting up at the crack of dawn to go to the pool and so on and so forth. And you know, again, driven by that routine. So imagine it's just as hard to step away from that environment. And also imagine it's just as hard to stop training, to stop wanting to put your body through everything you've had to put it through before.
Yeah, it's interesting because we see both sides of this, because actually, if you think about it from a mental health perspective, we all know, like, the value of physical activity, if we were talking on a general societal level, we'd be telling people, move more because it's good for you.
Yeah.
Like, we often sort of forget that bit with sports people because we assume that they are physically fit human beings. Well, actually, they need to find some form of routine around what are you going to do to continue to be active for your health going forwards, because actually yeah. that's really important. And you see some sports people throw themselves into big challenges and things like that because that actually gives them some of that sense of drive and purpose.
Yep.
Some just stop altogether, and actually that's not good because they're even losing the mental health benefits of just moving and being active.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you do see that, don't you, with sports men and women, a real contrast between those who you can clearly see have just stopped and you can see visually in them the difference a couple of years out of their sport has made to them. And others, and we had Franny Benali, a former Southampton player, on the show a little while back, and he was telling me about all these incredible, insane, ridiculous Ironman challenges that he throws himself into. So you do get both kinds, don't you? Both different cohorts of people. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's actually an important part. It's like losing, like having that can help give a sense of drive and purpose, and obviously it's really, really good for you. So yeah, I see lots of people do it, and depending on the sport, it might be more things that might not be quite so high impact, because that's one of the other things that we often forget about is the physical injuries that sports people have. That, like, some of these things are life impacting. So, and the things that we forget is, so I was speaking to an Olympian who we were having a comparison about dodgy knees.
Okay.
And I naturally assumed, well, I'm assuming all the support and all the health insurance and stuff that you had while you're a world-class funded program is still there when you retire. And she was like, no. That's not down to me to fund if I want that. But like, she's got, you know, things that are just need ongoing support and treatment. Like, a lot of sports people, well, like, you know, some of the contact sports and a lot of the evidence in rugby, like, you know, these things are, and there's costs to that, and there's obviously impacts of those things. So again, it's another one of those things that you're dealing with, and people will say, well, the sacrifices are worth it. You speak to sports people for the things they've done. Yeah. But we also still have a duty of care to look after people who make those sacrifices for us as sports fans, or people that are businesses and corporates that are making money out of sport, to make sure that the people that are competing are also looked after.
Yeah. And talking about looking after those people, do governing bodies of sports have a responsibility there? And do they actually honour that? Or literally, once someone retires or they're injured or they walk away, does that stop completely? Are some sports better than others in supporting their former stars?
So when we set up Switch to Play 10 years ago, there wasn't a lot going on, frankly. There's a lot more now, a lot more realization of this, and that's great. So sport has come a long way. There are still examples of places where it's better than not, and there are some amazing individuals within the sporting system doing some great work supporting individuals around their more holistic development and all of that mental well-being. So we are definitely in a better place, but you also have to recognize that there are large gaps, because not every sport is as well funded, so the infrastructure and support around them isn't as great. And then one of the challenges that you often find is the conversation around responsibility, because there's personal responsibility on the individual, the athlete, because it's their life, but the employer, the coach, or the sport, the governing body. So where does duty of care fall? And there's the danger that everyone's pointing at everyone else, going, well, it's their job, we've done our bit. They've retired now, so they're no longer our employee. It's their job over there, or it's the agent's job, or like, and that's the bit. The danger is no one takes ownership of it.
Yeah.
So in some places, there is great support in place for sports people. In other places, that's a little bit less. And actually, so what we try to do is work with organizations to support them in terms of the expertise that we can provide, but also in other areas of why we're a charity, where there is a provision, we need to be able to try and provide that opportunity to give access to support for sports people who otherwise wouldn't have it.
Sure. Well, good job you're there to pick up the slack, if you like, then for those sports where that isn't in place. It fascinates me, again, just going back to my days when I worked for a football club, that a lot of the players didn't really have to do anything for themselves. There was a player liaison manager there, I remember, who would, you know, buy their tickets for them, you know, even sort out their, you know, all their household bills for them, and pretty much they were entirely wrapped in cotton wool in terms of, you know, all the club wanted them to do was focus on their football. So the club would look after pretty much everything else that went on in their lives. So I imagine when you step away from sport at that kind of a level, it's a shock to the system, not only in terms of what are you going to do, but how do you live? How do you pay your bills? How do you do all of this stuff? Because I imagine a lot of people, a lot of sportsmen, maybe that's not something they've ever had to worry about before.
Yes, and I think certain sports, there's definitely that bit where they are so wrapped up that aren't doing anything. But there are risks to that. So you've seen some examples with financial planning, for example. Is if you place all your trust in someone, and there are examples where people have been given poor advice and it's impacted them hugely from a financial perspective. Well, like some of the stuff we would say is like, it's not that you necessarily need to be an expert in this stuff, but actually how can we upskill people to be able to ask good questions, to have a level of understanding, to understand some of these things, that if they've got advisors or people supporting them in these areas, that they're asking good questions. Mm-hmm. And that's a bit about personal ownership, but like not just expecting it to be done by someone else and it all be okay. So, and I think, you know, where you see that biggest, I think football, professional football at the top end is definitely that case. But those scenarios where people are wrapped into that level of sort of bubble are probably in the minority when you think across the whole sporting spectrum, because sure, a lot of sports people that we see who are competing at the top level are what you'd call dual career. They have a job outside of their sport that they need to do alongside their sport to be able to live and enable them to continue to play.
So it's stark contrast to the bubble-wrapped footballers. They're having to live their lives and do everything and do their sport and focus on that as well.
Yeah, and huge pressure. So we've done some work with non-league footballers, as an example. You're trying to hold two full-time jobs, effectively, and then having time for relationships and all the other things outside of those things. That's a hugely pressured environment. And some of the dual career athletes that we've worked with, say in netball, if the job that they're doing is about always around bending around the sport, so they're doing something that might not be what they want to do long term, but it earns some money and this gives them flexibility. When they ultimately finish their sport, they're still starting from the same position, because the career they really want to do, they're starting out on, rather than actually, is there opportunities where we can work with employers to be flexible that allows people to start their longer term career alongside their sport rather than wait till the end?
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. I want to ask you, I mean, the figure you quoted earlier on about 50% of professional sports people suffering from mental health issues within 2 years of leaving their sport, it's a startling number. In your experience and with the people you work with, is there an equal sort of gender split there, or does do either gender impacted more on that front?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think what we recognise is there can be different considerations when you think about gender. Obviously, most women's sport is still not only on a par to some men's sport. If you think about some of the stats, so there was a BBC study around relatively recently, talked about 60% of top female sports people earn less than £10,000 a year through playing sport. So, like, there's some financial bits to that. But even then, you think about it in terms of families. So, like, if you've sacrificed or put back having a family till later in life because of your sporting career, there's an additional consideration to then, what do I want to do from an occupational point of view, but also then having a family. So there's definitely some things in there that we find. And then also, you've still got, I guess, challenges that we have societally around inclusion in the workplace. You know, think about Paralympic athletes, disabled athletes, and actually their opportunities to be able to work post-sport as well. So there are definitely different dynamics at play depending on profiles of sport and profiles of different athletes. And I guess that's part of what our job is, to understand what those things are, what support we can wrap around them to help them. And we've got partnerships with organizations like Includability who work with inclusive employers. And they're the sort of organizations we want to talk to because they are open-minded and actively searching out people with different backgrounds and profiles because they see the value of what they can bring to their workplaces.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic to hear. So just digging a little bit deeper into that, in terms of, you know, those impacts on men and women differently. Interesting to hear you talk about the different impacts on women in terms of some of the things that challenges that are facing them, and I can totally understand in terms of you know, women focusing on their sport and perhaps putting off family life until a little bit later down the line. But for men in particular, and obviously we talk a lot about men's mental health on this show, are there certain issues in particular that the male athletes and male sportsmen particularly struggle with?
It's a great question. And I was actually just previous to this listening to a presentation from a GB boxer, like incredible young man who's just really inspirational. And he talked about like the nature of the culture, particularly in his sport, is like that showing of vulnerability is not something that is expected. And obviously part of what we're talking about in terms of mental health is about it's okay to not be okay and to open up and share what we're feeling. And actually in sporting environments, that can be quite difficult. So I think there's definitely a gender bit there. I don't think it's isolated to men, but I think there is definitely a cultural bit around sport, and that can be worse with men who don't traditionally or like stereotyping, but open up as much. That can make that worse. I think you also have to recognize what sporting environment brings is opening up, but it's who you open up to. Because if you're having a conversation with someone that might have a role in selection, perceived or otherwise, are you really going to tell them that you're struggling? Because you want to play on Saturday or you want to be selected for the next event. So there's an inherent challenge there that people perceive that actually admitting that you're struggling will impact on their job that they actually want to do.
Yeah.
Which can help, can ultimately make people suppress some of that. So there's a real, that's again, it's a big system thing that we need to think about as sport, is about how can we ensure that there are safe spaces for people to have conversations, that they are not just saying it's okay, but like creating the culture in an environment that allows that to happen and not to ultimately impact upon people's future livelihoods.
Yeah, I think there's the stigma around mental health society-wide. You know, I think that rings true, and I think, you know, for the rest of us as well, I think there's a lot of times where people are reluctant to talk up or to ask for support because they're worried it might impact their prospects of promotion or whatever that might be. So if it's the same in sports, I imagine as well. And I know in sport, it's quite often, you know, when I worked at a football club, quite often, you know, I wondered whether the footballers ever would try to sort of hide an injury because they're worried about not playing on a Saturday. So I imagine it must be the same with their mental well-being as well, of course.
Yeah, and you see it in some of the examples. Think about a lot of the discussions that are around concussion in sport. Like, I don't know, if a conversation with individuals to talk about it, like, sometimes you need to have someone that's going to protect the sports person from themselves, because they're going to always want to go out there and compete. That's their passion. It's their job. So like making sure that we've got the right support around, that someone is saying, no, actually, no, you've had a concussion. You should not be playing. And that needs, and like some of the protocols that have been put in place in sport and like how we get better at that stuff, because ultimately sometimes we have to get in the way to protect people from themselves.
You're right. Some people would be their own worst enemies sometimes, for sure. Tell me a little bit about the work of your organisation and the difference you're hoping to make. And tell me a bit about your hopes and ambitions for the future, and where you want us to be, or where you'd like the organisation to be in sort of 5-10 years' time.
Great question. So Switch to Play Foundation is the only charity in the UK that exists to help all sports people across all stages of their sporting life to successfully transition to life beyond sport. And as a lot of what I've said is our model is around prevention. It's about working with people through their sporting journey to help build the skills, experiences that ultimately sets them up for success. And then practically supporting them on their journey when they are actually going through that transition. So in the last 12 months alone, we've supported around 2,500 athletes across 60 different sports, huge cross-section in terms of profile of sports and athletes. But we'll work with Premier League footballers, academy footballers, younger players around their life skills development in terms of supporting them on that side of things, right through to supporting and mentoring people at the other end of their sporting journey through to like finding their purpose and helping them on their pathway to beyond sport. And I guess in terms of the question around like hopes and aspirations, I think the big thing for us is, and it is a broader thing that we can achieve alone, is like a sporting system that recognizes that the well-being of sports people should not be the acceptable collateral damage for achieving success on the field of play or in sport. Like, it doesn't have to be that way. The examples that we talk about developing yourself as a person and the perspective that brings and allowing you to be a better athlete, we can have healthy environments and achieve great things in sport, and it not always being seen that there's a particular way that it needs to be done. And ultimately, what does success look like? Ultimately, not us not needing to exist because sport's doing it. That's what success looks like.
Fantastic. That sounds good. Although no one ever wants... It's a strange one. It's a lot like sort of cancer charities say that they exist not to exist. But of course, it's a great strap line. But I'm so glad that you do exist and you are there to support men and women at those vulnerable moments. But tell me, I'm assuming as well, and you mentioned it earlier on as well, that we're not just talking about you being there for Premier League footballers and people at the top end. You're there for people in all sort of levels of sport, as it were.
Yeah, so there's sort of like a talent pathway or like on an like academy environments and those sorts of things. So you're like from age group national competitors, that sort of point of where sport is getting serious and it's something you have aspirations to do. That sort of, and that spectrum is very broad. But because obviously fundamentally, the support and that sporting journey, that starts from that point, ultimately. The thing for us is actually, and in terms of trying to make ourselves redundant, when you think across the broad spectrum of sport and age profiles, there's plenty of work to be done. So, at the moment, like the level of work that we do is ultimately constrained by the resources available to do it. Part of our model about being a charity is that we recognize that sport isn't always, and certain sports are not always well resourced. So how can we bring other investment in to ensure that there is support there for sports people?
So if someone listening to this is finds himself in a bad place potentially, or worried about the future, or worried about what's going to come after they finish playing or performing at whatever level they currently are performing at, in whatever sport that might be, what would your message be to them? What should they do? What should be their first port of call?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think there's a thing for me that is it will be okay, firstly. And then it's about be curious and starting to show some curiosity to thinking about your identity and interests outside of your sport. And that starts a ball rolling to conversations and building a network and maybe meeting different people and getting exposure to different types of opportunities, which as a sports person, you are privileged in cases you're often exposed to these sorts of different opportunities. So that curiosity is probably a great starting point. And so I think that's a great place that I would tell people to start. At a practical level, what we do at Switch to Play is always, we'll always have a conversation with any sports person. It's always free of charge. We don't want cost to be a barrier to the support that they get. And it's always then building a personal journey for them, because if they're not thinking about retiring for 10 years, great. What can we do to help you now? Not about thinking about 10 years' time, but the things that we can do to help you now will help you now, not just in the future.
Are there networks in place, and does your organisation host such things for people who perhaps would like to talk to people who are 10 years down the line in their sport, who maybe have retired and have gone through that transition. Are there facilities in place and methods by which, you know, if I'm a you know, professional athlete and I want to talk to somebody who's 10 years ahead of me and has retired and is now living a different life in a different way, how can I do that, go about doing that?
So we do it at two levels. So we have coaches and mentors. So there are from life coaches through to mentors that maybe more have been those sort of profile of individuals that sports people can get support from. So we'll pair them up at an individual level. And then at a community level, that's what we're doing a lot of work trying to build, is all those peer-to-peer networks. Because we see this huge value of just being in a room with other sports people and just being able to open up and share some of your thoughts and your feelings and your hopes and your experiences. And actually when sports people hear, oh, well, I've done this and actually I did this and it was great. And like they can support and learn from each other. And actually some of the stuff that we do is just trying to facilitate spaces like that, which are safe spaces where sports people can come together and just connect and share some of those experiences.
Yeah. And what about, for those people listening to this, and let's face it, probably the vast majority of people listening to this aren't going to be professional sports men and women, because we wish, probably a lot of us wish we were, and especially when it comes to, I mean, I'm a runner rather than anything else, but, you know, I look on professional runners with, you know, unbelievable envy that they can do the things that they do, because I'm not even remotely close to anything like that. So most people listening to this aren't going to be professional sportsmen and women. But what would your message be to them in terms of being aware of some of the issues that they might not even be aware of, the fact that sportsmen and women suffer from these? And what could they do if they wanted to perhaps support some of their sporting heroes in the future?
Yeah, it's really important, because I think what we recognize is, well, ultimately there's a hidden majority in sport and we care passionately about this cause. But there are hundreds and thousands of amazing good causes out there and charities out there raising money for good causes. So for us, it's like, if you're a sports fan and you might even, or not even be a sports fan, but know a friend or family member that's been through this, chances are this will resonate and they'll see some of the experiences from people that they've known. So I think it's like, be there for people in your life that maybe are going through that journey. Recognize that, even if their aspirations are about being a sports person, that there's much more to them than being a sports person, and their identity and supporting them and encouraging them to be curious, I think is really important. And then, yeah, selfishly on a practical level, if you want to get involved and support something, we're a charity that, like, small charity competing out there, like doing a challenge event for us and supporting us in different ways is always hugely appreciated.
Well, absolutely. And I will put all the links to Switch to Play and your website and socials and everything in the show notes for the show. So anybody who's listening and would like to find out more, to donate and to get in touch, perhaps I will put all the links in the show notes so they're all there for people to find out more.
Thank you.
Rob, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a fascinating conversation. And yeah, it'd be great to keep in touch and perhaps we can find out a bit more about what the future has in store another time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
That's it for this episode. Huge thanks to Rob Young for giving us an insight into a side of professional sport that the rest of us might not ever have considered, but which is clearly vitally important to address for the mental well-being of those people who dedicated their whole lives to the sport they love. If you'd like to find out more about Rob and the work of Switch to Play, you'll find all the links to the website and to Rob's socials in the show notes. You'll also find our episode question there too. And this time we're asking, how did you feel when your career came to an end? Our Yes No poll, meanwhile, asks, have you planned for life after retirement? You can answer both on the Spotify episode page, the link to which can be found in the episode notes through the Linktree site in the show profile or the Brave Front website. As ever, you can also interact with the show by sending us a voice message to tell us what you think of our guests and the subjects we're discussing. You can also tell us your ideas for topics and things you'd like us to cover too. Again, just head to the show notes, Linktree site or the Brave Front website for more details and the links to do so. And finally, if you've enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and follow us on whatever platform you usually get your podcasts. Every review and follow helps others to find us. In the meantime, though, look after yourselves
and I'll see you soon. Take care.